Hello, friends of Soul Kitchen. Thank you for listening to my podcast. My name is Jasper Mutsaerts. I'm an entrepreneur, adventurer, coach, and wisdom seeker. With Soul Kitchen, I interview people that inspire me, from TED speakers to social entrepreneurs, from activists to artists, from dreamers to seekers, from business people to spiritual teachers. With Soul Kitchen, I empower people to live their quest. Each episode contains a recipe for life. What is your quest? Hello, friends. Welcome to a new episode of Soul Kitchen. Today, I'm sitting with Alessa Burke, the founder of Top Tier Impact and the host of Road to Utopia, a new series on Gaia. I don't know if you know Gaia, but it's the Netflix for spirituality. And she's also a thought leader and a public speaker within the field of climate and impact investing. And recently I started hosting vision dinners where I bring visionaries together in Carvoeira in Portugal. And through these vision dinners, we got in touch online. And when I saw the profile of Alessa, I thought I have to invite her for this podcast. And today we will talk about her journey towards climate and impact investing, her journey as an entrepreneur, and her view on life around changing paradigms for society, communities, and planet. How are you doing, Alessa, today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Jasper. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. And why are you actually interested in the topic of climate and impact investing?
Yes, it really feels like on the critical path of where humanity is going. Like if we look at where we are today and how we have developed as an advanced society, an advanced civilization, and the challenges, the big challenges of our time, impact, climate, and let's define impact for a second, because we understand impact at Top Tier Impact as a paradigm with values like sustainability, inclusivity, diversity across all economic sectors. So it's about embedding self-sustaining values, because sustainability itself is much more than just, okay, recycling and circular economy and all of that. It's a set of values. So it's about embedding those values in our systems, in how we operate, in how we interact with each other, in our economy, in politics, in society. That is the idea of impact for us. So it's something happening across all economic sectors, across all industries. So for me, impact, climate are extremely exciting because it comes down to solving very meaningful problems we face today.
And when did you get interested in this topic? Is it something as a child you were already interested in, or did you have kind of a wake-up call later in life?
That's a great question, because as a child, very early on, I started being interested in understanding, this is really as a small child, understanding how things work on our planet in terms of how we exchange and interact as humans. So that led me to economics early on. It led me to system design and governance design early on. So it was always like understanding how an ecosystem gets created and functions, right? Or evolves. So going from all those fields into entrepreneurship, because entrepreneurship was also something in my blood, where I started at 11 years old with the first little business, reselling books and toys, and going into tech entrepreneurship during my time at Oxford, during my studies. I then started in the investment space, where I felt like I got a broad view of the world, then eventually venture capital entrepreneurship, and that's where impact came, as in this modern definition of impact, because the way that I resonated with impact was twofold. On one side, it was like, I resonate with impact because I've always gravitated to tech businesses or startups that have a positive innovation component, right? So they're doing something positive for the planet, for people, for communities. And then the other part was me stepping back with that system design governance hat and thinking, this is a better paradigm, you know, it's a better paradigm for our economy and our society. So I would like to help take this paradigm into the mainstream. That is how I first came across it.
And in your career, I think you worked with Goldman and Blackstone before you set up your own business. Did you already work in the climate and impact space there?
Not really. I wouldn't say that I worked in climate. I would say that impact by the time I got to venture capital started overlapping, because some of the tech businesses that I would look at would have a positive impact as part of their business model, but others wouldn't, right? Like others would be automation for whatever marketing campaigns, like this, these kind of things. Like it really depends like where I would look into. So I started overlapping with that, but never directly until the point that number one, I became aware of it. And number two, it finally started being higher on the agenda of priorities for investors and for companies. Mm.
So with your current business, can you explain what you're actually trying to achieve and how you do it?
Yeah. So at Top Tier Impact, we say our mission is to take into the mainstream impact and sustainability for how investments are being made and how companies are being managed. So really taking these into the mainstream, how do you do that, right? We have a couple of different businesses under Top Tier Impact. What we are known for is our global network. We have members, registered members who apply to join, either just directly to us or through our other members and ambassadors, and they get together across 30 city chapters around the world. And the synergies we see are investments being made, new companies being formed together, hires, partnerships, everything. You know, it happens every week at this point. And it's really satisfying to see, because those synergies are how the individual successes of these leaders in the impact space grows the impact space as a whole. So that's how we do it through the network. And then we have another side that we've been growing. So on the investment side, working across emerging markets as well and going into verticals that have an impact component, but perhaps need help, need more like dots to be connected so that investment can also move and those sectors can grow. So basically, you know, the way that we fulfill this mission is to try and find a systemic angle to grow impact in whatever activity we do.
And if you look at the impact network, how do you select or attract people? What are kind of criteria based on that someone can join or not join?
Yes. So when we first started at Top Tier Impact, the network side was only investors. So it was any investor with an impact, regeneration, sustainability kind of angle. And then we started becoming more of an impact economy, meaning it's not just investors anymore. It's also founders, professionals, some public figures like known figures or scientists or policy writers, policymakers. And so we really had this expansion of the types of stakeholders that come together into Top Tier Impact. At the core, there's a lot of investing, entrepreneurship, and then the corporate side kind of comes after that. But what we and why we did it is to recreate a little bit of a petri dish where it's a whole economy with different interactions, as opposed to, you know, just one type of stakeholder. And the criteria that we always have is obviously there needs to be the impact angle within someone's profession. I think there's always personal screening as well. So, you know, the professional screening is one way or the other walking the walk in this profession or transitioning into this profession. That's also very valuable because we want to see more and more people coming into the impact space. So when someone comes to us applying, and either as professional, as investor, as founder, they're coming into the space. We're very open. We're very excited about that because, yeah, the transition needs to happen, right? And we can support with that like we have in the past years. So that's one part, you know, the professional side needs to be there. And then the personal side. And I think the personal side is extremely important because at this point, you can ask any member at Top Tier Impact and they will tell you the people are so good, you know, and it's good humans. It goes beyond, oh, they do things that are relevant to me. You know, it's good, supportive humans who actually embody these values I was telling about in the impact space. You know, these values of sustainability, inclusivity, going a little bit deeper on a human level, right? So I would say that we have people who on a professional level and on a personal level are impact people.
That's beautiful that you have created that at such a global scale. So you make those connections. And can you give a concrete example of a company that has been created out of this?
Yeah. So we actually had at the World Economic Forum in Davos, this company of two people who met through Top Tier Impact and decided to create during this conference that is seen as a very, you know, corporate conference, a bit hostile, you know, not friendly. But they decided to create a space for impact entrepreneurs, impact investors called House of Trust. So they created that out of meeting through Topsy Impact, putting together a company, and then putting together this whole event venue during a conference like Davos.
And House of Trust was created in Davos.
It was created out of meeting each other, mm-hmm. like these two members in Davos. But then it's more than that. You know, it's a company in itself.
Yeah. And House of Trust, what does it do? It brings people together, or it's an
accelerator? There's a company underlying that I think does both the investing and the accelerating of companies.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's amazing. And what do you see is the main challenge in impact investing? Because I think impact investing sounds fabulous, but let's say I have €1 on my bank account that I can invest. Someone else, I can get a higher return. Maybe people are kind of doubting. I don't know if that's the case, but what are kind of the challenges of getting mm-hmm. people into this space?
Well, I think that first of all, there is a challenge that is actually a broader challenge of the whole climate change space, which is that if you take climate and climate change, it's a complex hyper object. What does climate change mean, right? Like you can hear 100 different, you can't touch it. It's not like this lamp behind you. It's not like this microphone. You cannot concretely understand, right? So you can only project your idea of it. And this can be confusing, right? This can be intangible. And therefore, this can put you off in the first place, right? And with impact and measuring impact, it's similar. I think that often people cannot relate to it. Like, it sounds good, but I don't know. So what I often see is that people enter the impact space from a strong personal angle, right? Emotional angle. So for example, there are investors that enter the impact space because education is really dear to them, or the health space is really dear to them, right? For personal reasons from their life. And then they start looking at how can I support it? Like maybe, you know, going beyond philanthropy, because of course these are the big investment opportunities of our time. So it's not just about philanthropy, right? But they start learning about it like that. And I think for people in our day-to-day lives as well, or putting, you know, some savings on a monthly basis into impact, one of the problems is, again, this abstractness of how can I really tell if this company is better than the other one? And here is where I think part of it is obviously researching. Part of it is getting informed and building opinions. But then another part is also the industry doing a better job in giving real transparency, right? Because often, unfortunately, a lot of companies want to sound like they're impactful, or they follow ESG or whatever sustainability framework, but the reality is different. So I think that this is an ongoing working process.
So you say many people come from a personal angle, whether it's education or healthcare. Mm-hmm. So from all the impact themes, like which one are you most personally connected to or most passionate about?
Wow, that's a great question because, you know, I get to see them all the time. I would say that it depends. Like sometimes there's one that really comes up. So for me right now, it's nature, land preservation, land restoration. Regenerating communities, or regenerating mostly like pieces of land, because in this area there is a shift happening where there could be a lot of capital to be unlocked to do more preservation, to do more restoration. When you think about it with CO2 emissions going in the atmosphere today, absorbing them back into, you know, out of the atmosphere today is extremely more valuable than absorbing them in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, right? Because we can reverse a lot if we do it today. Soil absorbs CO2 very efficiently, but our soils are degrading. You know, they are degrading because of how the agriculture and food industry has operated for the last decades. And that's a big topic that we could also go into. But basically then the question is, what can we do to prevent that, to slow that down, or ideally to reverse that, right? To reverse from harming to regenerating instead. And so again, you know, in there, I tend to kind of zoom out, look at the system. In this case, I do see how there are a few sources of capital that could enter the space and standardize it as an asset class so that suddenly there's much more capital available. There's hurdles to be faced in there, but I find it exciting. And then, you know, for me personally, I have a deep, deep connection with nature. During COVID, I used to live in London, but I found myself in Asia. I lived deep in nature. You know, we were on an island in community. It was so beautiful. And in general, I always need to go in nature a lot. So, you know, my deep spiritual connection with nature is something that comes like very intuitively and is, you know, a big part of my life. And so, of course, translating it into work, into the economy, into how we can actually make sure that at a larger scale, we preserve nature. That's very exciting to me.
And you mentioned for land preservation, you want to reallocate capital and create like an asset class. Can you elaborate a bit more what that means? Mm-hmm. Also, maybe for people that never heard about it, like what does that mean?
Of course. So right now, when you think about it, we've had this big problem where some call it the tragedy of the commons, like the commons, like the air we breathe, the waters, like the forests, like forest is a bit different, but in general, we haven't been able to go about these common resources in a way that truly values them. In an ideal world, we wouldn't have to worry about it because everybody knows and feels and respects their value. Unfortunately, that's not the world we live in today right now. Therefore, what else can we do, right? So from that viewpoint, preserving nature at scale. So for example, reforestation rather than deforestation, or agroforestry and forestry management, right? In there, it comes down to, for example, taking degraded land. There is a lot, and these I noticed like a lot of people, like we don't know it's normal, but at scale, there is so much land that unfortunately has been degraded by agriculture. It has, in most cases, made dependent on fertilizers. And in most cases as well, after that cycle, it gets to a point where it cannot be farmed anymore. So for this kind of land, someone who understands regeneration, there are plenty of ways to regenerate that land. Comes with a cost. It can be quantified as eventually there will be a return. And if that land is managed in a regenerative way, it can keep on also being farmed on a certain cycle. So produce something, but do it in a way that is very sustainable and net it's beneficial. Now, this is not rocket science because this is actually how we used to manage land centuries ago. Again, last century, we introduced a whole new system of agriculture and food management from, you know, this green revolution that was like, okay, fertilizers and monocrops and all of that. And eventually we got ourselves in trouble. This is also what leads, you know, these like monocrop, cheap, low quality food at scale that leads to population growth, but in a way that doesn't become fair to everybody. You know, we live in a world where there are a lot of disparities, right? And so all of that leads to this. So going back to what we're talking about here, what is nature preservation and what does it mean nature as an asset class? It means to find ways where the economic value of nature is inserted into the equation. And so preserving land, managing land, and nature-related resources, such as forests, right, such as rivers, can be done in a way that gets taken into account and therefore valued appropriately.
I think there's a Dutch foundation called True Price, and they also say something similar, that you need to incorporate the cost of nature into pricing.
Yes.
But it sounds like a beautiful idea, but it's also not so easy to change. So what is needed? Do governments need to increase taxes on certain industries, or do people need to increase their price? How do you change the price to include nature?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And you started it off in a good way, because I think at the end of the day, policy incentives from governments are absolutely essential, because it comes down to reshaping the business environment, you know? And so, yes, putting taxes, because in an ideal world, this is something that will be incorporated and taken from the extra margins of large companies and large industries. That is my view. I think there's plenty of margins in there. I do not think that it's fair to just put it on the end customer. And it's also not effective, because changing habits of people at scale is extremely different. If I tell you, hey, tomorrow you can, you know, your shower is going to be cold and you take it for 1/4 of the time, you're not going to be very happy, right?
No.
So that's the whole idea. And these incentives then also lead to businesses to really change and reshape their business models, right? In line with these natural resources, in line with the commons and, you know, removing negative externalities. So yeah, my view is that it comes down to that policymaking as well. I'm not saying that it means that you and I can just ignore all of this. Of course we don't, right? But I think that part, like the policy part, so public government on one side and corporate readjustment on one side, is absolutely key.
So policy change is important. And in your network, are people more focused on impact investing at, let's say, organizational level, or are some of those also involved in changing the policies around it?
I would say it's more about the actual investment and then the technologies and the business models that can make a difference without needing to rely on these changes, right? Because it's a very difficult game to play to have to rely on some hoped for policy change. So I think that for investors, especially when it's, you know, tech, early stage, or an innovative mindset in the impact space, there's this self-reliance, right? Like, this will make sense anyway. And in fact, it will be so much better than what was there before that you will want it anyway, right? So we don't need to rely on regulation.
So it's mostly focused on the investments that are not dependent on some policy changes. And can you mention a few climate technologies that you're excited about or that you see potential in?
So something that may sound like quite core to an industry is, I give you an example of a business that I met in the green ammonia space. So sustainable fertilizers, like green fertilizers. But the thing that I find most interesting there is that their facilities are in emerging markets as well. And their intention is to grow in emerging markets. Why? Because what happened is that fertilizers were invented in the US, like post-Second World War, and the boom that happened from there. So what you have today is a situation where Africa needs to buy fertilizers from markets like the US, mostly, for higher prices than US farmers pay for these fertilizers. So they pay 2 to 3 times more for exported fertilizers, you know, on boats and ships that consume, and planes, whatever, that consume a lot of CO2 to bring them over to a continent that is much poorer and yet has to pay 2 to 3 times more. Meanwhile, their lands have become dependent on fertilizers. The soil becomes dependent, right? And I think that this is a parallel we can draw to how dynamics are. These dynamics, we can talk them about, you know, between people, right? Like, do we interact in a dynamic of dependency or interdependency, right? Like, as empowered agents. And it's the same when you look at the soil, when you look at, like, you know, economic dynamics. So basically, like, this has happened. And, you know, the number one part becomes, how do we make sure that these prices are not being paid, that production can be localized? And then number two is, well, actually, how do we make sure that the land doesn't need these anymore? How can we go to regenerative models at scale that wouldn't even need that? That's a much bigger challenge. But yeah, let's give you an example of a company in the green ammonia space. So producing fertilizers that can be sustainable and can be local to markets.
So this is an example. Thank you for sharing this one from Africa. And is this the one that you've done in Senegal, or is that a different example?
No, that company is a financial inclusion company. So that is a mobile bank. And it's a mobile bank where what we did, we supported in the process of raising debt from international investors, development finance investors. The terms of that debt are much more favorable than private markets local to Senegal. I mean, definitely not in Senegal, but like local to Africa, let's say, or foreign funds coming into Africa. So the interest rates are much, much lower with these investors, but there is a gap in education as well to bridge, because investing in financial inclusion and digital infrastructure has been newer for a lot of investors. But what does this mean? You know, what's the bottom line of this? The bottom line is that the end consumer, so a normal Senegalese person, can access mobile banking services, perhaps some simple debt services, at a much lower rate than before and in an easier, more straightforward way in their day-to-day life.
That's amazing. And what type of cost saving do you then realize for, let's say, someone in Senegal?
Mm-hmm. I definitely know, you know, the cost saving on a company level, because on a company level, what you're looking at is a single digit interest rate, like all in with these markets and with these companies. It can be something between like 6 to 8%, which is very, very low, rather than single digits like high teens, you know, like 15%, right? Now, what ends up being the case for the end consumer depends, but typically would be cheaper debt, but also better services, right? Better financial infrastructure to access.
Well, that's a beautiful case example. And when you share it, for you, it's quite normal. But for me, someone from Switzerland that ends up arranging these deals in Senegal, I mean, it's not something you you hear every day. So how did your life get into this space, or how did you end up in Senegal?
It's a funny reflection, actually, because, you know, knowing myself, it's not surprising. No. But I grew up in Switzerland. I'm Swiss Brazilian, so I really have kind of a unique perspective, right, from integrating two very different cultures into one, and, you know, willing or unwilling, embodying that, you know, so learning how to do that. And I always wanted to go out and explore the world since I'm a little kid. And so as a little kid, it was very simple. It was just like this drive. But when I became a teenager and then went into my studies, it was just clear that I wanted to be in places where I could be part, actually, of making a difference, you know, making a difference in our economy. Helping reshape systems for the better was always the drive, like we talked earlier today. Yeah. And I had to get out of Switzerland for that. So I moved to England. I went studying at Oxford, and then I started my career in London. And London is probably the most international city you can find.
Yeah.
And I loved feeling that, you know. So that felt like home, actually. Like that level playing field where it's okay that we are also different, it's accepted, it's not a problem. That felt really, really good. I do remember my transition being like, oh, this is great. And so, you know, from there onwards, like, my career became international, and it became also an exploration in a way. I do feel very much of an explorer spirit in me, which gets translated into entrepreneurship and into pioneering new things. You know, I feel it's a core to who I am and to how I enjoy life and living life. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I can say specifically how it happened in the case of this company in Senegal, but in general, this is the framework, you know.
I can imagine. So this multicultural background is the foundation for this. And if you look back, what would you say you learned from, let's say, your Swiss roots? What did you learn from your Brazilian roots?
That's a great, great question. Sometimes I say, you know, I feel like I have a lot of both.
Okay.
So I have a lot of the Swissness in terms of perhaps like on the work side as well, like making things happen and, like, you know, going for it, and perhaps a resiliency. The Brazilian side is like, I'm very expressive, you know, and so even these TV series that we were talking about that I was approached to do with Gaia is a natural part of what I do, because expressing to me is very important. Again, it's how I process life, is part of, I think, my purpose as well, translating things. So I think it's my expression. I think it's my passion and enjoyment for life. You know, it's my fire as well. If I have a lot of fire as a person. Is my dance, right? So it's like those parts of me that are very important to me and complementary to how I live life.
So the expressive side, the playful side from Brazil, and like the getting things done, being organized. I don't know how organized you are, but Swiss are known to be organized. You touched upon the topic of the television series, The Road to Utopia. So some of those ideas that you have are utopian of nature. So can you elaborate a bit what this Road to Utopia is about? What the concept is?
Yes. So I really will start with where your question is going. So what is it about? Because when I came up with this name, and this name really came to me, it's Road to Utopia. Okay, fine. And people have all kinds of projections about utopia. And it was very interesting for me to witness, you know, because some people would be like, oh, but I don't know about utopia because this term is used like this and that, and utopia means this and utopia means that. To me, utopia is an individual, unique, subjective choice. You have your utopia. I have my utopia. Everybody has their own utopia of what does it mean to live a life on purpose, to live a life empowered, to live a life moving towards creating that utopia every day, short term, long term, right? That's how I see it. So this utopia, Road to Utopia, it's a bottom up utopia. If everybody can be empowered to create their own utopia in life, automatically we create a beautiful collective picture. We create a beautiful collective utopia. And that utopia is like a puzzle, right? It's not like this is what's good and this is what's bad. No, it's everybody's choice in an empowered state reflected in the kind of planet we can build together like that.
So you believe that if people reach their individual utopia, it also contributes to this collective utopia.
Yes, absolutely.
That's beautiful. And I think the series is like 8 episodes with different themes. Like, what type of themes have you chosen?
Yeah, we have 8 topics in the impact space. So each one is reflecting a sector, you can say, of the impact space. Alternative education, regenerative communities, new forms of energy, meaning fusion, geothermal. We have psychedelics and consciousness, so mental health and consciousness expansion as a whole. We have the circular economy with businesses focused on circularity. We have longevity as a field, breath work as well. And there's always one that I forget. There's an 8th one.
A bonus. We can discover that in ourselves. I like these different themes. And what is interesting to me is breathwork, let's say education, energy, regenerative communities, circular economy, those I would probably expect. Mm-hmm. But then breathwork is a little more surprising. I mean, I can understand that it's an underlying thing that can lead to other things. But why have you chosen to include breathwork in those 8 themes?
Yeah, so I wanted a mix of outer world and inner world. Mm-hmm. I think that our outer world is just a reflection of our inner worlds. And so being able to have a balanced mix of inner world supportive sectors, I see breathwork as that, because breathwork enables us to come to presence, enable us to feel ourselves more, or to heal, or to feel more energy, or whatever it is. You know, my friend in that episode who talks about like their breathwork business and the space talks about pranayama as a pharmacy of techniques, right? So you can do it to calm your system, you can do the parasympathetic stuff, which is what I believe more in, which is to calm your system. You can do also the energizing ones. That's a different area. So I see breath work, longevity. I remember the other one, there's inner development, where we feature a really interesting visionary, I would say, to your words, a really interesting visionary there. I think that having this balance of outer world and inner world is important for the series.
I see. And what has breathwork meant for you?
So I have to say that for me, I am more of a student of yoga, many different types of yoga, of somatic emotional practices, and you know, deep self-reflection, and a few other things, ecstatic dance, kirtan, singing. So I wouldn't say that I am someone who has made breathwork like their main modality. You know, I have friends who have, both in just their personal life or even as a business. For me, breathwork, I relate to it with yin yoga, actually, where if you really follow your breath cycle, you are slowing down your system, right? So the way I see breathwork ultimately is like the awareness of our breathing cycles and how we can get ourselves back to present. So I tend to prefer the practices that are more about that as opposed to intense activity.
I see. So yeah. It's not your main modality, but it's something that has positively influenced you. Mm-hmm. And you, I think, have interviewed this Mind Valley teacher.
Yes, Neeraj.
Neeraj. Why have you chosen him?
you made a selection and you choose mm-hmm. one, or how do you come, how do you invite your guests?
Some of our guests I had known for a long time, and others were new. I think for the ones that I knew already, I know that they really walk their walk and they really believe in what they, like, you know, teach. They really believe in what they are trying to embody every day. So I very much knew this for Neeraj to be the case. It's his story, you know, it was a game changer for him. It was like sheer drive of like, I have to bring this out. Like, first of all, him coming even before discovering breathwork, like wanting to empower people to not be reliant on, let's say, going to the pharmacy rather than just adopting healthier habits, you know, that's his story. And then he went through the journey, and then it was like a calling to share this out with the world, right? So for people to walk the walk is essential, you know, if things are to really make a difference to other people, I believe. Yeah.
So it's really important someone embodies it, has walked it, and not only talks about it. I think you also interviewed Marcus Aubrey, mm-hmm. and one of my previous guests suggested that I should look into him. But why have you chosen him, and what's kind of his message for the world? Mm-hmm.
I think that his message, so he's in the psychedelics episode, because he has himself walked that path, and he has focused more. He's not, let's say, I could have brought in a founder of a psychedelic focused business, mm-hmm. like psychedelic assisted therapy through telemedicine. For example, that's an option, because in the US, some drugs have become legal for therapeutic purposes. And so you could also feature that, for example, or you could feature a biotech business. In his case, and there's no better or worse, but in his case, what I think is interesting is that he has translated his own personal journey into messages that can be brought out to people as well. So as a point of reference of walking a path that includes medicine like that for like healing and empowerment purposes, I thought it was a really interesting one to dive into.
I see. So you chose not like a business founder, but someone that has walked it, and he's also a bit of an influencer in the space, right?
He's a founder as well. He's a serial entrepreneur himself in areas like performance nutrition. So yeah.
You've done one episode on psychedelics, and on your website I also saw the founder of Tabula Rasa, who holds like psychedelics house at Davos. So how do you see this connection between the psychedelic space and like the economic investment space, and what are your learnings?
Great question. Actually, I'm about to host right after our interview. I will be hosting a venture capital panel on investing in psychedelics and mental health areas at an early stage. And he or his partner in the fund will be on the panel as well. This is a broader discussion, because what I actually said at this psychedelic house of Davos, at that event we hosted together with them a few years ago, a couple of years ago now, is that at the end of the day, areas like mental health, psychedelics, consciousness expansion, and innovation there is a root cause area of investing. So root cause of impact, meaning it's a little bit like what I said before, inner words and outer words. Your outer world is a reflection of the inner world. And so, you know, if we're coming from a place that is caring, right, that is integrated, then what can be built in the outer world, infrastructure, climate, businesses, regenerative farming, like whatever, can be a beautiful reflection of that. And so as an area of investing specifically, because I think that psychedelics, like all these areas, is much more than just investing. I don't think that investing is the solution. I think the solution is everybody taking charge of their own path and exploring ways in which to grow themselves, heal themselves, and walk their walk. So that's not investing, basically, right? It's like a self-investment. But when it comes to areas of investing, such as psychedelic assisted therapy, such as platforms for delivering maybe mental health therapy at scale, when it comes to these areas of investing, I call them root causes. So root cause of impact being that it influences everything else in the impact space.
So psychedelics and breathwork are these types of things that can influence the, And in your, because I think Inspired Action is one of the things that you want to achieve. Like, how do you make sure that people take action after watching these television series?
Yeah, the idea of the TV series is actually to give a little bit these energy transmission that you get from these entrepreneurs and these sectors and all the things you learn about the sectors and through the entrepreneurs to be like, whoa, that sector I really like. Maybe I want to go do something there. Or if this person can do it, so can I, right? Because we try to portray everybody else in a very human and relatable way. I think that's extremely key because like putting people on a pedestal like, actually makes no sense. And so that's the whole idea of it. So if someone walks away and decides that part of these 80,000 hours we are given in our life for our work and our career, right? It's about 80,000 hours. Mm-hmm. Like part of these hours can be moved into impact, into something positive, into any of the sectors you've seen in the TV series, that would be amazing because I think that is the most direct and powerful way in which anybody can do, can have an impact is to shift their day to day and, you know, their working hours into something more impactful.
I think that's a beautiful mission. And there's a Dutch writer called Rutger Bregman. He wrote a book about moral ambition. Mm-hmm. He says that one of the main wastes of this era is people wasting their talent. And he wants to make sure that people move toward more morally ambitious work fields. Mm-hmm. So he's also a bit criticizing consulting, banking, accounting, law. Have you heard about this Dutch guy or not?
I haven't.
You should check him out. This book is called Moral Ambition. Mm-hmm. Do you see that in your own surroundings? I mean, you worked at also more traditional institutions. Do you feel that's a big problem of this time, that people are wasting their talent on topics that are not so important?
Actually, I think it's a big transition of our times. So I don't disagree with this Dutch writer. And yet at the same time, I think that's changing. That's really changing. So when I graduated in 2012, the most like interesting thing was still finance for most students. Then shortly after I graduated, it started becoming tech and startups, but startups that are like big enough to employ people. So that was a transition. Now it's becoming climate impact and sustainability, right? So you can see that there is a trend happening and it always happens first with the younger demographics, younger people. And then hopefully gradually trickles down also like within the system and those who hold either assets or influence or political decisions as well, right? It gets taken in there, whether it's willing, right? Because if there's an inner drive or whether it's because there's an outer push towards it, right? That cannot be ignored. So I do think that this is changing, but it's absolutely essential. So I would say that around myself, I mean, there's a self-selection as well. If you're in the impact space, you naturally hang out more with impact people anyway. But what I observe more broadly, for instance, looking at graduates, looking at trends like that is a big change.
And you're talking about different generations. So what is the age of people that you expect to reach with Road to Utopia?
So I would say mostly it's a millennial audience. And as millennials, we're right bang in the middle right now of the economy. So not old, but also not out of university. So there's an interesting intersection. I think it might be interesting to younger demographics just because they tend to be more into all these topics anyway. But so are we. So is our generation. So, yeah.
Beautiful. Well, I hope you reach a lot of people. Do you have certain goals for how many people you will reach, or you kind of let it go? You'll see what happens.
I would say definitely let it go because we're lucky that Gaia approached us. We will share it and, you know, have viewings across our chapters around the world. Maybe I'll invite you to the one here in Amsterdam if we do one in Amsterdam as well. But I would say let it go. And the reason is because this, for me, doing this work was an adventure, a big adventture in itself. So I have to say I am satisfied to have made it through the finish line.
I can imagine.
So maybe in a few months I will tell you, okay, here are our targets and all of that, but for now I'm like, it's done, that's great, that matters.
Because how long was it to produce these 8 episodes?
I mean, the whole journey has been a couple of years, and it's funny to tell you this now because I used to think, oh, why do movies and TV series take years? That makes no sense. And now I know exactly why.
So what's the main thing you learned from all of this, looking back?
Wow, there's so many things. So how can I pick one thing? What I have learned, perhaps what comes up is sort of like these, I do it quite a bit with entrepreneurship. I think it's this continuous zooming in and out. So it's zooming out to see the entirety of what needs to happen, but then zooming in as well to find and address the challenges of every specific part of the process. So it's a continuous zooming in and out process that I think allows to learn faster and maybe be more agile in adjusting as well. I have my own ways of doing it with the businesses, I guess, and I think it's in life in general, it's a good thing to do, but definitely to do this here, to keep on understanding where are we at, what are the challenges, but wait, where are we at in the whole picture as well of the project?
I remember one of my former colleagues from McKinsey taught me the concept that to balance between being on the dance floor and being on the balcony, whereas balcony is really the zooming out and dance floor is being in the operational activity. And if you have to specify how you do that, like, is that, do you create a mind map? Do you walk in a forest? Can you specify how you how you implement this company?
I like the walk in the forest. I'm more on that side for sure. It's not like some, for the zooming in and out, yeah, it's definitely not just like, oh, I have this specific framework and I just do it. Often it's a mix of writing things out and having conversations and then letting it all absorb, you know, and perhaps doing very different things like being in nature, gaining insights. And then again, you know, like writing some things out, discussing others, reflecting, and then letting everything move.
Yeah. But I think it's a very important skill. And if I zoom out, let's say, on your business, what I can immediately see is that you have this global network and you have this ambassador approach. I mentioned that I had a travel company a long time ago, but in 15 student cities, we had 2 student ambassadors per city. Mm. It worked very well. It was only in the Netherlands. But can you share a little bit about your approach to scaling or growing, let's say, your project or your organization, and how you work with these ambassadors and what goes well and what the challenges are? Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm asking, I feel it's an approach unique to you. I don't see it with everyone. Mm-hmm.
So there are different businesses to top tier impact, and this is specifically in the network, which, like I said before, is what we are known for, because you can notice it, it's very active, there's lots going on. And the idea of top tier impact and the members, the network, the value of the network is this local and global approach of, we have all these local chapters with their unique differences, with their specific interests, with their ways of doing things, but then they can all connect globally to all other chapters. So if you travel anywhere, you can plug into the local ecosystem of the city you're going to. Or if you are, as an investor, as a founder, going into a new sector, a specific sector, you can suddenly meet people who are experts in that sector all around the world and gain different perspectives, right? So the local to global part, and perhaps the governance of, you know, a flat type of system where it's more about the horizontal dimensions, you know, to the company, and having space for independence is important, comes very natural for me to do. You know, there's not like a tension for wanting to hoard or all of that. I also think that it's an interesting experiment, because it's something that there's a lot of organizational theoretical frameworks out there about how you do these more like horizontal structures, and you know, and then you need to test it out, right? So this is also an experiment at the same time.
I can imagine. And how do you recruit such an ambassador? They come to you, or?
Yeah. It's members of the network who really enjoy it and are getting a lot out of it, are being active, and they want some leadership in it as well.
And sometimes with decentralized organizations, there is a bit of a battle between the central organization and the decentralized organization. Has that already happened in your case, or you haven't encountered it yet?
It's funny. I mean, I wouldn't say we have battles, but there's always like reconciliations, you know, because there's always different perspectives. But the funny thing is that early in the day, we actually had the opposite of what you're describing, as in we had the local chapters or the local sectors asking for more centralization and more guidelines. Whereas I was like, because, you know, for me, this was a big realization about how I operate versus other people operate, because I tend to be very independent. You know, I'm entrepreneurial in my DNA. You know, I like to have freedom to do things on how I think makes sense. You know, and so I kind of assume like everybody wants that as well. Great. But a lot of people wanted more, and so I was careful with not giving too much like directions and rules and so on. So it's a very nice balance to thread, because of course we can come in right away and give more rules and structure. That's never a problem. So I see that. And then at some point, you know, maybe there's the opposite demand, right? Like when we do that more, at some point there's more of the other. So it's a continuous balance. And growing networks is not like growing a software product, for example, right? In other words, it's not like once you nail the core formula, every additional unit you can just keep selling. Networks are unique at every stage of development. So it's quite different.
Yeah, and it's more human interaction and human needs.
Yes.
So some of those chapters, they wanted more guidance, whereas you didn't realize that because you're entrepreneur of nature. Yeah, that's interesting. Interesting lesson learned. And do you have a role model or inspirator in life? I mean, related to network building or maybe in life, like who inspires you?
Ah, good question. There is no one person that I would mention for sure. But I constantly learn and get inspired in very different places. For example, right now, my main source of inspiration is this Taoist master who comes from a lineage of Taoism, Tai Chi, Qigong, that I have been learning from in Asia, and that I think embodies presence and awareness in a very impressive way, embodies wisdom in the way that he talks about all kinds of situations. I'm really inspired by that. And I find it a very powerful practice for meditation and presence. So that's a source of inspiration.
And is presence something you struggled with?
Good question. I think that early in my career, I would say so, because early in my career, it was such an intense work culture, you know. I think as a child, it's different. Like I was always someone with a very vivid imagination. I loved learning. I loved school. So, you know, that was actually something I enjoyed. But then early in my career, hard work culture with a lot of things that are not necessarily enjoyable, like results in yes, like you might. And then it takes you a while to notice like, what's going on, right? We were talking about that earlier. What's going on? And so I think that it's for me, this path, this journey in expanding awareness, right? To be more, I think like expanding presence just means like, having more depth to life and having more depth to every moment and to how we experience life, and it's infinite. So for me, the journey has been on the professional side, gradually, constantly adjusting to what makes sense for me, what I enjoy, what I'm good at, right? So this ikigai concept. And then on a personal level, I see it more as emptying the cup. In other words, people often talk about the personal journey of like adding this skill and that skill. And like, no, for me, it's been like unlearning, decluttering, healing and making space, making space for simplicity.
Emptying the cup, I really like that. So instead of adding a lot of new skills and new things, you want to empty your cup. And can you give an example on how you empty your cup?
Mm-hmm. Vipassana meditation. More recently, Qigong and Tai Chi, ecstatic dance. Oh my God, I love here in Portugal. I'm trying to find more places for it. It's a very embodied dance where I feel for me, what I love about ecstatic dancing is that there's just this free expression, and the free expression allows us to kind of like move through whatever is real in the moment. So I love that. Singing. Yeah, singing kirtan, kirtan singing and singing circles, I find very powerful to just like find that depth in oneself, in the group. What else has been part of that? A lot of different modalities. I will leave it here.
I like all of those, but Vipassana meditation I've done once. I felt very inspired, but also challenged. Mm. I was like scratching a lot on my head, but I didn't even notice. At some point, the teacher came to me, like, look at yourself, you're scratching your head. Yeah. But I would like to do it again. and see how it is later. But what I realized during Vipassana, that sometimes I'm very reactive, like when I get an email that triggers me.
Yes.
At the time, immediately responding.
Yes.
I think after Vipassana, I unlearned it. It doesn't make much sense.
Yeah.
And what was your experience like this Vipassana? Like, what did you get out of it, or what did you learn from it?
Mm-hmm. I think it's more a mindset for life. So I really like your example, because for me, of course, the experience itself over 10 days is very powerful, but then it's what remains in our awareness about how we can practice that on a day-to-day basis. So being present in the body and noticing what's happening in the body, any part of the body. Like the emptying the cup process on a physical basis is actually tension release. Hmm. Tension release is where we are struggling with life instead of going with life. And that is where we can empty the cup naturally, right? And so that's where the awareness in the body that Vipassana teaches, and that kind of meditation of being present to see what's going on there, allows us to release, allows us to empty. So that is a day-to-day thing that we can see in anything.
I think that's a beautiful description. And you mentioned this inner world and outer world, and Vipassana is an example of the inner mm-hmm. world. All these investors that are part of your network, are many of them interested in these types of inner world, or not necessarily?
I would say increasingly so, yes. And I have seen it changing every year. I have seen it increasing every year. And I have also seen how in unexpected places, let's say a very institutional, large corporate investment setup, when we just show up sharing where we are, for instance, you know, I don't believe in preaching, right? I don't believe in any right and wrong subjective perspectives. There is no objective right and wrong. There are subjective perspectives. And then there are values, right? And like values, like valuing life, like that you could say is objective, but I think it's different, right? Because we tend to operate with our own right and wrong. This is better. And now you need to do, I just did this new modality. You have to do it. Otherwise, you have no idea, you know? But instead, just sharing from your own place of truth, like what you've been doing, is something that I often do. For example, during COP, I was sharing about some of my plant medicine experiences, mm-hmm. but just sharing my experience, you know. And I noticed, like in very unexpected places, in terms of investors, a lot of interest mm-hmm. and questions and curiosity. I think it's changing a lot.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful how you're bringing those different worlds together, the breathwork, the psychedelics, the Vipassana, and then also the investing. I think it's a beautiful combination. And do you have a network that you can be part of yourself, because you're creating this network for other people? Or are you surrounded by peers where you can kind of learn as well?
That's a great question. I was part of many different networks over time. And I think that, you know, in a way, that's also how I got inspired, or how I knew that it's so valuable, because it was valuable to me. For example, I've been part of Masterminds for Entrepreneurs as kind of like a collective coaching out of a network that I was part of earlier in my career in London. At this point, I hope I'm not missing anything. I don't think there's a specific network. It's just more like different communities, you know, that I am part of, and that sometimes come together and sometimes are just different.
Yeah, so it's more different communities that you're tapping in and out of. Mm. So talking about communities, you're just arriving in Portugal. Like, from all these worldly adventures, why have you chosen Portugal, and what do you hope it will bring this next chapter?
Yeah, actually, on this note, like Portugal right now has become such an amazing melting pot of different communities, different people, and yet with similar values. That's the really cool thing. I was actually replying to a friend who posted a question the other day on Instagram, and he was, one of these question polls, and he was like, would you rather relate to same religion, different country, or same country and different religion? And I was like, same value, different anything else, you know? So I think there is a common value alignment here that is amazing. And then yet so much diversity around it. I love it. There is also nature very close to the city. I mean, you live in nature here in Ericeira. Me being in Lisbon, it's quite easily reachable, you know, 20, 30 minutes. So yeah, it's a very good mix of things for me.
I'm happy to hear. I'm also excited about part two. I'm just discovering it, but yes, the people at the Tract I'm very excited about. So we discussed a lot of topics already, but as I mentioned in the Soul Kitchen, I ask people their recipe for life based on all these decades that you've been on this planet. So if you will summarize your life so far, and what's kind of the recipe that you would like to share with the listener?
Yeah, so you mentioned the changing paradigms part before. And of course, I love tackling paradigms, translating different paradigms. But I would say that the recipe really is this bridging of inner world and outer world, and inner health and outer health, and our inner incentives, our inner drivers, our inner personality with what's on the outside. I think that the ability to keep on merging them, right, and walk the walk. There is a saying that I love, and I think this saying is one of the wisest things I've ever heard. And it says, when what you think, you say, and you do are the same, are aligned, you experience peace. So for me, that's the, recipe.
So what you think you're going to do, and you, can you repeat what you think you'll
what
be
you
doing?
Think, what you yeah. think, when what you think, what you say, and what you do are aligned, are the same, you experience peace.
I see. What you think, what you say, and what you do. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful recipe. Is it something you also learned from this master?
No, I learned it much earlier. Yeah. And it came in and out. I really like the Asian wisdom disciplines, Buddhism, Taoism. So I think I must have come across it at some point. But I think this master definitely embodies that.
So it also means that if you're thinking about stuff, but you're not doing it, that there's misalignment.
Yeah. Or if you're thinking something that bothers you, but you don't find a way of saying it, for example.
So it bothers you, but you're not expressing it to anyone. Right. Yeah. Well, beautiful, beautiful recipe. I think your intention was to also share actionable inspiration. So before we end the episode, are there any suggestions you want to share with the listeners on how they can take action, or any final comments?
Yeah. I think what we were talking about before with the TV series is a great place to zoom in. So this shifting of career, because if I talk about this with people in our community, either in the impact space or moving into the impact space, no brainer, they're already in the impact space or in climate, aligning their life with what they care about. But for anybody who doesn't feel there yet, or feels that it's somehow not possible, doing an audit, an audit of your life, your career, maybe the sector you work in. What are angles to be impactful? I give you an example, like the people that I have collaborated with on the TV series and the production, they are people working in the media sector, right, in the film production space, but they only do things that have an impact as projects, right? So no matter what your skills are, no matter what your industry or your area of business and working is, there are angles to move towards the impact paradigm. So it's a little audit to do.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Everyone, thank you for listening. I hope you're inspired, and see you soon.
See you soon. Thank you.